You're listening to Baseline from 538.
You're listening to Baseline from 538.
You're listening to Baseline from 538.
You're listening to Baseline from 548.
538.
Damn it!
538.
Hi, this is Carl Bialik from 538. Welcome back to Baseline, the podcast that we're recording live from the U.S. Open throughout the tournament. Joining me today, our guest is Harvey Araton from the New York Times, a sports columnist and feature writer. Welcome, Harvey.
It's good to be with you, Carl.
We are recording on Friday, and the women's final is Saturday, and 538 is forecasting every match at the tournament, as well as who's going to win the title. We've been doing it all tournament. We now have a lot fewer things to forecast. We're down to the point where we just have one match on the women's side, and we're giving Angelique Kerber 59% chance to win the match and win her second major title of the year. How do you see that match?
I like Pliskova to win the match. I think her potential, I think Kerber's a very good player, a very solid player. I don't think she's a great player. I think the fact that she's left-handed helps her because you don't see a lot of lefties. But I think Pliskova has the potential, and we haven't seen it until this tournament or maybe Cincinnati, to raise her game to a level of being, you know, a quasi-great player. I mean, she has a big serve, she has good ground strokes, and she's, you know, showed tremendous poise in this tournament to take out both Venus, you know, on Ash in the, I believe, fourth round, and then Serena the other night, even if it was a subpar Serena. You know, we've seen Serena win matches that way. So I like Pliskova, and I think that she'll, you know, this is going to be a complete run for her.
Yeah, this reminds me a little of Marin Cilic a couple of years ago, where he also hadn't done very much at majors, had a lot of potential, tall, big serve, and blew off the court some great players, and Pliskova could complete that run tomorrow.
Yeah, the Cilic thing was painful. I've always been a big Fed fan, and you know, he walked out there for that semifinal with the opportunity, knowing that Djokovic had lost to Nishikori, and you know, he'd never lost to Cilic and basically got blown off the court. But when you're into your 30s, like Serena the other night, you have these nights where somebody comes out with fresher legs, a younger body, and it's just not there. The movement is not there. And so, that's why I'm picking Pliskova, because I think that she has that similar kind of game. And I think Kerber is very good, but not a great player.
Whatever happens in the final, Kerber is going to be the new number one. It ends a period of, I think, over 3 years that Serena Williams was number one. Serena Williams also turns 35 later this month, and her sister is 36. They're both still in the top 10. They're still competing with the best players at majors. You've watched both of them over their careers. Do you feel like they're entering a new phase? I guess they're both in different phases now, but what do you see next for them?
Well, I think Venus is... it's obviously a great story, but it would take a miracle for her to win another Grand Slam event. I mean, she just, you know, there's always that one match that does her in. I think she'll play a couple more years. But as for Serena, we've now seen her lose or not win. I guess it's four out of the last five slams. And it reminds me of a quote that Isner gave me up in Toronto earlier this summer when he was talking about the Big Four. He said, look, you know, nobody's, you know, beating down the door to get at them, but the other guys are starting to reel them in a little bit. So you can kind of see the tour, you know, it's a different player each time starting to reel Serena in. I believe she will win, you know, she'll get the 23rd and maybe 24th and even 25th. When healthy, she's still formidable. But, you know, we're very spoiled here in the States with Serena. We've gotten used to having someone, you know, an American at the top, and that's going to change in the next couple of years. He's going to see a much more wide-open women's tour.
Speaking of spoiled, in your article, John Isner, who you just mentioned, who's been the top-ranked American for most of the last, I'd say, 4 or 5 years, said American tennis fans of the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s were pretty spoiled, much as they are since on the women's side with the Williams sisters. Do you see it that way, that they were spoiled at the time and that was a fluke, or do you think now is a particularly down time and things will return to what they were then?
I don't think we'll ever see the days when, you know, Americans were could be counted on to be playing in the finals of slams. Tennis is not golf. I mean, if you look at the top 50 on the PGA Tour, you know, it's Americans, Australians, an occasional Japanese player, you know, maybe a Spaniard. But tennis is really a global sport now. And, you know, Eastern Europe, obviously Russia, you know, China, I mean, everyone's represented now. And it's that much more difficult you know, there's only a few truly great players, and it's that much more difficult for Americans to get into that, into those positions. But I think, you know, we'll see. I think Francis Tiafoe has a lot of potential. I think Taylor Fritz looks like a comer. That could mean, you know, with luck, with, you know, more development, you know, a top five player could also mean a top 15 player. And there's a big difference between top five and top 15. So I don't think you can take anything for granted. But the other thing is, I think that real tennis fans, I mean, we definitely get the casual tennis fans during the Open who sit upstairs and like to roam the grounds and pay attention maybe for two or three of the slams per year. But the real core tennis fans, I don't think they really care that much. I mean, to them, I mean, Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal and, you know, the great players, going back to Boris Becker and Rod Laver, they're citizens of the world. Sharapova, does anybody really know the difference between, think of her as a Russian? So I just feel like the real core tennis fans, you know, to them, they latch on to players. They like a player's personality. They get to see their story develop through the years. I think that trumps, pardon my expression, I think that trumps the notion of whether it's an American or not, especially, you know, when it comes to events like these.
I really hope the presidential election this year doesn't ruin the word Trump, because it's a good verb to use. So.
I've used it prior to his, you know, candidacy, and I'll keep using it.
Yeah, let's hope it lives on. You mentioned Federer and Nadal there. Neither of them are in this last four. Novak Djokovic is the all-time great who is. Do you not mention him because you think he doesn't have that same kind of global citizen appeal to tennis fans, and in particular to your audience at the New York Times? Is it more difficult to write a story that they'll care about when it's him instead of Federer and Nadal, despite the amazing tennis he's played?
Yeah, I think for our interests, I mean, the Times has really become, you know, more than ever an international sports section, you know, because of the web. So it doesn't make any difference whatsoever. You know, the event kind of makes the player here. I'm a big Djokovic fan. I mean, traditionally I kind of silently rooted for Federer because I love the way he played. I mean,
silently, no cheering in the press box.
No cheering at all, but maybe some fist pumping a little bit. But
no rule on that.
You know, but my heart goes out to Djokovic because this poor guy, he's had to play Federer a couple of times in the final at Wimbledon, where everybody, you know, loves Fed. He's had to play Murray at Wimbledon in the finals. And, you know, when everybody wanted, obviously, Murray to win in the UK. For those reasons, because, you know, Federer and Nadal are great fan favorites, and Federer's career has lasted so long, Djokovic has a hard time generating crowd support almost everywhere he goes except the French Open. There, I think they really appreciated how badly he wanted to win, and they really showered him with affection when he won it this past June. So, but overall, there's a guy he's a wonderful sportsman. He's got a great sense of humor. He's articulate in press, in media interviews, but he has not crossed that. He's not transcended that place where Federer and Rafa have already gone to. Probably will take him getting a little older and a little more vulnerable for him to do that. And I think something like the Olympics where he cried, you know, he was so
losing in the first round.
Yeah, losing in the first round at Del Potro. Things like that start, you know, getting into people's minds and hearts. But probably when Federer and possibly Nadal, you know, have completely faded as contenders, Djokovic will be seen with a little more, I think, sympathy.
You have to get worse to get more loved, perhaps.
Usually. I mean, Stefan Edberg here at the Open, almost nobody paid attention to him. They appreciated his tennis. But at the end, they were cheering for him like mad because he was about to retire.
We're about to get to someone who similarly was cheered for near the end quite heartily here at the Open. But I quickly wanted to ask about the semis later today, Friday. We have Djokovic given a 90% chance by our model against Gael Monfils. Serbian against a Frenchman, and the global citizenry of the game, as you described, although Europe dominated, especially on the men's side. And then the second match, we give Kei Nishikori, a Japanese man, 65% chance over the Swiss Stan Wawrinka. And then we give Djokovic a 75% chance at winning the title. How do you see the rest of the men's game unfolding here?
I think Novak caught a huge break with all these retirements against him because he came in here with a bad wrist. And also trying to put behind him some disappointments early in the summer, the Olympics and obviously Wimbledon. So I think you know, Monfils is another one of these guys who, you know, he can look brilliant for a set and a half. But I think Novak is just too steady, too good at creating offense from defense. And I think he will win in four sets. I like Stan's chances against Nishikori because I think Stan is one of these guys who, again, has the ability to raise his game. While it's not consistently great, he can raise it to great. He's got that wonderful backhand. And, you know, I wrote something earlier as a preview to the tournament that you could actually make the case that Wawrinka is a stand-in, an occasional stand-in for the big four. You know, I mean, it's a guy like, and he's won two slams. I mean, up until Andy Murray won Wimbledon this year, he had as many slam victories as Murray, and Murray was considered an automatic member of the big four because he's won more tournaments and has been more consistent. But based on the sheer ability, Stan has that possibility of raising his game to a great level. So I see him winning that match, and I see Djokovic beating him on Sunday.
All right, that'll be quite an exciting final. I think any of them would be. But Djokovic going for number 13 here in his third of the year, and Wawrinka going for his third major. Today is men's semifinal day, as we said. We're recording on Friday. Your first Open for the New York Times had quite a memorable men's semifinalist, Jimmy Connors. He turned 39 during the tournament, and a 39-year-old man making the semifinals is basically unheard of. And here was an American making this great run. There's a great ESPN 30 for 30 documentary about it called This Is What They Want. Did you know this isn't just going to be a good story for the next day, but this will be a match and a I mean, you didn't know Connors would win his next match, but you already knew he made the quarterfinals. How big did you realize at the time this was?
I had this feeling, and I think I wrote in my column, you know, that night. It was a fierce deadline column that this was going to be one for the ages, because I had the good fortune that night. I was sitting there watching the match in the old press box high atop Louis Armstrong Stadium, and sometime I think middle or late fourth set, Arthur Ashe sat down next to me, and we just wound up spending, you know, the last set and a half having this running dialogue, and Ashe was like beside himself, you know, with what was going on. I mean, Jimmy was 39. It was his birthday. It was Labor Day. You know, he was the essence of the working man's tennis column. Tennis player. And I remember at one point Ashe said to me, you know, were you here for 78 when Connors took Borg apart in the final? And I said, as a matter of fact, that was my first Open ever. I mean, I really didn't know much about tennis, but the newspapers in New York were on strike. A couple of strike papers had popped up, and one of the editors I knew there asked me to cover the Open. I said, I don't know anything about tennis. He said, don't worry about it. Just get the results in. So that was when I became exposed to the tennis and the Open. And so Arthur said to me, that was Jimmy at his absolute best. And then he kind of smiled and, you know, looked back and said, this is number two. So, you know, you had an all-time guy, you know, with all the circumstances that went on that day. And I kind of had this feeling that was going to be an iconic match. And, of course, in the ensuing years when they showed it every chance they got, you kind of knew that was one that would stand the test of time.
I'm just curious, since you've been at every Open since, what are the biggest changes you've seen?
Well, it's just in 78 when the first year I came. In fact, I wrote about that in Friday's Times, because it was sort of a tribute to Louis Armstrong Stadium. You know, it's just become so much more of a mega event. And also, you know, I always got the sense that back then that it was, as we said earlier, kind of like, you know, a sport that you expected Americans, you know, and a couple of Europeans, you had the Swedes back then, to kind of dominate. But now it is so much more global. It does reflect the opportunities that are available in the sport. And also, I think, you know, we tend to see the opportunity through the lens of the Williams sisters coming out of Compton, California. But a lot of these players from Eastern Europe, you know, specifically, but in other places as well, are not from particularly wealthy backgrounds. I think that's one of the biggest changes that we're seeing now. That really hasn't impacted as much in the States yet as it has in other countries around the world, where kids not from, you know, truly affluent means are able to make their way to the top tier of this sport. And I think that, to me, is the most pleasant change. I mean, let's face it, tennis is a sport that requires a lot of money and a lot of parental supervision intervention. But I think slowly, because the sport has changed, it's become much more athletic, much more physical. I think it's attractive to kids in a way that it might not have been 30 and 40 years ago when it was viewed more as a softer game, more as a country club game. I remember when I was a kid, I used to read the Daily News, and Dick Young, their famous sports columnist, would always make fun of tennis. You know, just, oh, they're very prissy and they hit the ball, they slice it a little bit. But that's that image of the sport has changed, and I think much for the better.
One thing that, as far as I can tell, hasn't changed much is the stat sheet that we get. And this being a 538 podcast, I wanted to be sure to ask about that. In your column about that 1991 Connors-Crickstein match, you mentioned that Connors went to net 107 times. And when I look at some old articles for matches before that, you still see winners and unforced errors. It seems like we're basically counting the same things we've always counted in tennis. Are you surprised that as tennis has expanded in so many other ways that that part of it hasn't more?
You know, I wonder, I haven't really sat down with coaches or, you know, entourage types with the top players to ask whether they have gotten into analytics much, but you don't hear talked about much, you're right. The funny thing about the Connors, the 107 times at the net in that 91 match, is that Jimmy was not a serve and volley player. It just showed you how aggressively he played against Crickstein, who was a baseline who sometimes drove you crazy. It was like, please, Aaron, you know, you just hit a ball, you know, you just rocketed a forehand into the corner. Go forward.
Finish the point out.
He just was very much rooted to the baseline, which is probably his undoing. I mean, he's a very good player, top 10 player for a short period, but never got beyond that. But I do think it's the same thing. You know, basically you hear about unforced errors in tennis, which was always, you know, sort of a pet peeve of mine, because I've always said, you know, what is truly an unforced error? I mean, if Rafa Nadal is gotten into the head of Roger Federer, where he overcooks a forehand, because he knows if he doesn't hit the perfect shot, it's coming back at him twice as fast. You know, is that really an unforced error, or is that psychological, you know, a psychological warfare being fought that ultimately gets to a player? So tennis stats, you know, we mainly look at them, we mainly use them to kind of illustrate, you know, support some of the points we're making. But you're right, it has not developed, you know, in a way that the team sports have, you know, and maybe it's because it's just two guys out there, two players out there, you know, hitting the ball back and forth, and there's not as much to analyze. I don't know.
In your column about that 91 match, you said this is your last assignment for the New York Times, but you're not retiring. So before we wrap up, just tell us what's next for you and how you feel about it.
Well, I'm in the process of, you know, talking to some people about doing some other things. I would say that I'm retiring from the Times after 25 years, and I've been in the business a long time, like 40. But I'm calling it more of a downsizing, you know, breathe a little, ride my bike in the park a little more, and things of that nature.
Play any tennis?
I do play tennis. I started playing shortly after my first Open.
Well, I'm glad to hear this isn't the last tennis for you then. Thanks so much for joining us, Harvey.
It's my pleasure, Carl.
That's it for this episode of Baseline, which is the last one we're going to be recording at this year's U.S. Open. Thanks to our producer, Jorge Estrada, and for additional help from Jody Avergan, Tony Chow, Chadwick Matlin, Ryan Nantel, and Joe Sykes. Be sure to check out our ongoing coverage, including our continually updating U.S. Open forecast at 538, as well as coverage on ESPN.com and ESPNW. You can find past episodes in the feed for Hot Takedown, which is 538 Sports Podcast. And you can email us at podcasts@538.com with any comments or suggestions. Thanks a lot for listening.